on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. 50 years ago last August, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law.
Today is a triumph for freedom, as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield.
This morning, historian Taylor Branch and legal scholar F. Michael Higginbotham discuss that most fundamental dimension of our democracy, voting. We'll talk about how federal anti-discrimination laws at the time were insufficient in opening up registration, and we'll discuss the status of voting rights as the 2016 presidential race picks up steam. And a year after Dr. King's death, his widow, Coretta Scott King, visited Baltimore to support health workers who were organizing for higher wages at Johns Hopkins Hospital. We'll hear from two union members who recall that day. Happy New Year! Here's the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Happy New Year, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Last summer, we marked the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. Just a week after signing the bill that created Medicare on August 6, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed a law that made it illegal for states and local jurisdictions to impede the voter registration process and deny the right to vote to African Americans. Here's part of what President Johnson said at the signing ceremony.
Today is a triumph for freedom, as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield. Yet to seize the meaning of this day, we must recall darker times. 3.5 centuries ago, the first Negroes arrived at Jamestown. They did not arrive in brave ships in search of a home for freedom. They did not mingle fear and joy in expectation that in this new world anything would be possible to a man strong enough to reach for it. They came in darkness and they came in chains. And today, we strike away the last major shackle of those fierce and ancient bonds.
President Lyndon Johnson on August 6, 1965. This morning, we revisit a conversation about the history of the Voting Rights Act and the future of voting rights, and we'll assess the consequences of the 2013 Supreme Court decision that struck down one of its central tenets. Back in August, I spoke with two scholars from Baltimore who have studied and written about these issues extensively. Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the iconic history of the civil rights movement, America in the King Years. F. Michael Higginbotham is the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law and the former interim dean at the University of Baltimore School of Law. I asked Mike Higginbotham whether 50 years later, he agreed with President Johnson that this law would, in Johnson's words, strike the last shackle of the fierce and ancient bonds of slavery.
Unfortunately, it hasn't happened, but I do agree with President Johnson that it was a monumental achievement in the history of freedom because its impact was tremendous. Over 800,000 new voters were registered within 4 years of the passage of that act. And in Mississippi alone, the percentage of registered African-American voters went from 6% to 66%. And so it was a tremendous act that did much to help to get to freedom. But unfortunately, we're not there yet. And I know we're going to talk about what's happening today.
Was there anything about the legislation itself from a legal perspective that you think was flawed, something they could have fixed at the start?
Well, I think what you're dealing with in terms of the Voting Rights Act, of course, is a conflict with states' rights. And that's been, you know, that's been a huge deal since Reconstruction in our country. And the Voting Rights Act, when you look at the history of the 15th Amendment, passed in 1868, which said there shall be no race discrimination in voting, unfortunately, states were able to do things like literacy tests, poll tax, grandfather clauses, which basically made that 15th Amendment's promise nil. And so the Voting Rights Act was the first time that the federal government was able to pass legislation under Section 2 of the 15th Amendment to really give teeth to Section 1, which said no discrimination. So when President Johnson says it was significant, yes, it was. But the problem was, of course, it created conflict with states' rights. And that's been, I think, with us, and we're dealing with that even today.
And Taylor Branch, bring us back to the scene in the summer of 1964. On the 2nd of July, the Civil Rights Act passes. And then just a few months later, in December of that year, Dr. King is awarded the Nobel Prize. And then from January of 65 through what's known as Bloody Sunday in March, tell us what was going on in the South at that time and in the country in general.
The Nobel Prize marked a new phase in Dr. King's career, because it was the epitome of the campaign against segregation, which had been 10 years since the Brown decision finally gotten a law, a federal law outlawing basic segregation in the South. And Dr. King surprised his staff by saying, we're not going to celebrate or even work on implementation of this for a long time. We're going right to Selma to work on voting rights, which is even more fundamental. He had promised some of his staff members he was going to undertake this campaign to answer the Birmingham church bombing, which had happened in 1963, that until black people could vote in Alabama, you were going to have this sort of unanswered crime. And so he went there in January, straight back from the Nobel Prize. It really did mark a turning point in him as a prophetic leader, pushing forward to the next item on the agenda of what freedom really meant.
On the 7th of March, 1965, Dr. King was preaching in Atlanta, but a march took place, began from Selma, and the intention was to go to Montgomery. What happened on that day, which has become known as Bloody Sunday?
Well, that's been celebrated at last in the breakthrough film, Selma, this past year, that was nominated for Best Picture, that the state of Alabama repressed and attacked and tear-gassed and beat the marchers on Pettus Bridge, causing a national and international reaction, for that matter, that went all around the world because it was shown on television that Sunday night. And so that became the first of three attempts to march from Selma to Montgomery, and finally it was successful by the end of on March 25th, 1965.
So on the 15th of March, 8 days after Bloody Sunday, President Johnson called a special night session of Congress, and he pushed for a voting rights bill at Dr. King's, after Dr. King's advocacy and others. Here's part of what President Johnson said to Congress in this extraordinary session at night, just a week after Bloody Sunday.
What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
We shall overcome. Taylor Branch, what was Dr. King's reaction to hearing that, a phrase that President Johnson invoked about halfway through a 44-minute speech?
Well, he teared up. He was watching it in Selma with most of his staff. I think he expected a good speech, but I don't think he expected a speech as sweeping as it was. Right from the opening sentence, "I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy." It's a truly remarkable speech that is sadly lost to some degree right now because Johnson is such a flummoxing figure in American history. We don't realize what a shining example he was on fundamental issues like voting.
Mike Higginbotham, the legal landscape of 1965, you mentioned that there were precedents dating back to the 1860s and 70s, the three so-called Reconstruction amendments to the Constitution. But talk about specifically the kinds of things that Southern states in particular were doing to repress black people from voting.
Well, it's a very sad period in our history because there was so much hope after the Civil War, when the amendments were passed, Reconstruction amendments were passed, and a great deal of civil rights legislation was passed under President Grant's administration and the radical Republicans in the Senate and House. But what transpired was very disappointing Supreme Court decisions, beginning with Strouder versus Virginia, where basically the Supreme Court said that while states couldn't specifically pass laws to discriminate on the basis of race, they could regulate voting in terms and jury participation in terms of age and other requirements, such as, and this is what happened based upon those other requirements, literacy tests, grandfather clauses, poll taxes, where states were able to, and general criminal code, states were able to target certain crimes. And as a result, there was a tremendous disproportionate impact on the basis of race. And that's what happened with Strouder versus West Virginia. As a result of that, the level of black voting participation in many states in the South was less than 5%. And so that created tremendous problems, and that's why you really needed a Voting Rights Act, because you had Supreme Court cases that said states could pass these laws that weren't specifically mentioning race, but had a tremendous disproportionate impact.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, we'll have more on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. We'll talk about the Supreme Court decision two summers ago in which the so-called pre-clearance formula was invalidated. And we'll talk about Governor Larry Hogan's veto of a bill that would have given convicted felons the right to vote before they completed their probation or parole. More with Taylor Branch and F. Michael Higginbotham after a break for the news. Stay with us.
We shall overcome one day. We shall overcome one day.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Happy New Year. Thanks for being with us. Now we're going to continue our conversation from last summer about the Voting Rights Act with the historian Taylor Branch and the legal scholar F. Michael Higginbotham from the University of Baltimore School of Law. In June of 2013, the Supreme Court ruled that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act was invalid. This is the part of the law that required jurisdictions to undergo certain pre-clearance measures before their voting laws were changed. I asked Mike Higginbotham about the intent of these sections of the law and why the Roberts Court overturned part of them.
Voting Rights Act prohibits race discrimination and other types of discrimination in voting. And there's five sections in the Voting Rights Act. And Section 4 sets up a preclearance standard where the Justice Department has to approve of any states or counties that are covered under Section 4 has to approve any changes in their voting practices that may have a negative impact on racial minorities and others. Section 5 is the provision that identifies the formula for states that are covered. That's what in Shelby County, in the Shelby County case, that's what was struck down, the coverage formula. And basically what the Supreme Court said in a 5-4 decision, a very divided court, Supreme Court said that the coverage formula needs to be updated. It's been too long and things have changed. I got three problems with the decision. One, I think it's wrong on the law. I believe that a lack of deference was afforded to Congress, a co-equal branch, and the Supreme Court has always said appropriate deference should be given to a co-equal branch. 2006, Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act. They held hearings, and 99-0 in the Senate, 333-30 in the House. Basically reauthorized the Voting Rights Act and said it was necessary in 2007.
So, and they reauthorized it for 25 years.
Exactly. And so the Supreme Court basically didn't give them the proper deference. But I also think it reflects a lack of objectivity on the part of the court. It's a 5-4 decision. Five Republican appointees basically struck it down. Four Democratic appointees upheld it. So I think it undermines the objectivity of the court in that respect. It politicizes. But most significantly and most problematic, I think, is that to me it disrespects those Americans of all colors who fought and in some cases died for people to have the right to vote. We're talking about, you know, people like Viola Luisa, a white woman from Detroit who came down to honor Dr. King's request of people to come down and help during Bloody Sunday, during the March on Bloody Sunday. And so I think it's disrespectful to those individuals, and certainly we need to reauthorize that Voting Rights Act, and certainly it needs to be upheld.
And, of course, this involves certain jurisdictions, many of which are in the South, but some of those jurisdictions include Brooklyn, Manhattan, and New York. I mean, they include various places around the country, and it simply means that if they're going to change the voting procedures or the voting rules, the Justice Department has to okay it, has to just sort of give it.
That's the preclearance, and it's a really powerful provision to basically say, look, states, you can't change unless the Justice Department approves it, the federal government approves it. And it's interesting, the coverage formula, because as you mentioned, people are shocked that some counties, New York, some Brooklyn is covered, some counties in New York are covered. It's not just southern states. It's not just the old Confederacy states. But the reason for that is when you look at what the Voting Rights Act said, it said states that have literacy tests in 1965. It said states where there is less than 50% of individuals registered to vote in minority groups. Those states or those counties will be covered. So that's why you get Alaska. That's why you get certain counties in New York covered, because they satisfy that formula. And it's really, really problematic not to reauthorize this Voting Rights Act. It really is, because if you look at what's happening today, you have, you know, voter ID laws, you have limitations on early voting and same day registration. These have the same impact as literacy tests, poll taxes, and grandfather clauses had in the past. They may not have the same intent. We can debate the intent of these laws. But clearly they have the same impact, and that is very problematic in terms of the cornerstone of our democracy.
And Taylor Branch, of course, race is at the heart of this. You've done a lot of thinking about race. Matter of fact, you're conjuring up a possible book about this whole notion of what we mean by race and racial and post-racial. Justice Roberts is basically saying in the majority opinion that times have changed, that we are now in a post-racial society, and we need to have rules that that comport with 2015, not 1965. Do you see any evidence, you know, of us being a post-racial society the way that Justice Roberts sees?
Well, there's been tremendous racial progress, but at the same time, whenever anybody says that anything in politics is not about race, it's usually a pretty good sign that it is, because race still underlies and drives an awful lot of American politics. There's no other force in American life, for example, that could cause the two major parties 50 years ago to swap places on the race issue. The Republicans, who had been the party of Lincoln, 80% of them voted for the Civil Rights Act in 1964 in both houses of Congress. But a year later, they start to switch behind Goldwater. And Democrats, who had been the party of white supremacy in the South, solid South. When I grew up in the South, there were no Republicans. They were scarce. It was the solid Democratic segregationists. And as soon as Johnson endorsed these bills and signed these bills into law, the Democrats became the party of civil rights. So race drives our politics, and it still does. There's just an awful lot of dissembling about it.
So Mike Higginbotham, John Lewis, Congressman Lewis from Georgia, is trying to get a vote in Congress to update essentially the Voting Rights Act to the current conditions that Justice Roberts mentioned in his decision. Speaker Boehner is insisting that it go through the Judiciary Committee, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, a guy named Chairman Bob Goodlatte from Virginia's Republican, is against the bill, and he's decided not to take it up. Congressman Lewis is trying to get it straight to the House floor for an up and down vote, but it appears to be stalled. Is it your recommendation that the Voting Rights Act, as it existed in 1965, be renewed, or is it in need of a little tweaking and updating?
I certainly don't have a problem with tweaking and updating. I think when Justice Roberts said circumstances have changed and the voting rights needs to be updated, I think if you look at recent elections, clearly there are some states and some counties in the North, such as in Ohio and Pennsylvania, where problems have existed in our presidential elections and in our state and local elections. So I don't have any problem with updating the formula. In fact, perhaps it needs to be expanded to Ohio and Pennsylvania and some of these other northern states. But I do think that it's really important for us to make sure that we stand up for our democracy. We should be encouraging individuals to participate. I went to South Africa in 1994 for the election of Nelson Mandela, and they had three-day elections. They had people who had never voted before in their 80s and 90s waiting in line for a day or two to vote. And they had over 80% of their electorate voted. We need to be encouraging that. We need to make sure that our democracy works and encourage people to participate. So there are a lot of things that we could do, including an updated Voting Rights Act, that I think would help our democracy, not hurt it.
And of course, Taylor Branch, voting rights is one thing. Voting is another. In the last general election, less than 37% of the registered voters in the United States actually participated in the election. The general election turnout since World War II has been miserable in many ways. What are some of the strategies that people could enlist to increase voter engagement and engagement with the political process in general?
Well, ultimately it's the people's job. There's a lot of complication in these formulas and so on and so forth, but it's all quite simple. It's what do we mean by we the people? If we the people is the foundation of our government, do we take it seriously? And the fact that our voting participation has gone down and that there have been all sorts of subtle things to discourage voting is a bad sign for a democracy that rests on we the people. So voting is what the founders meant when they said we the people was a lot more people than have governed in the past, because it was a monarchy. So they were moving toward what we aspire to today, which is all the people. And that's really the basis of our patriotism. And we lose it in the weeds a lot when we don't have a lot of participation. So we all need to be encouraged to figure out ways to make we the people real.
Michael Higginbotham, Governor Hogan vetoed a bill that passed overwhelmingly in the Maryland legislature that would have allowed felons to vote as soon as they got out of prison. Maryland had one of the most progressive laws on the books about felons' rights in voting, in that it allowed, since 2007, it's allowed ex-felons to vote once their probation or parole is completed. This bill would have allowed them to vote the minute they got out of prison, even if they were still on probation and parole. Many felon disenfranchisement statutes are sort of state-specific, but is there a common thread in that? And what do you think the argument for allowing felons to vote is? The governor simply says that not being able to vote is part of your debt to society.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, you know, when you commit a crime, there are certain penalties that can be imposed. But once you have done your time, perhaps we should have you reengage in society, and certainly voting is one of the ways that can be done. There are three approaches. One is sort of you get the death penalty in sense of when you commit a crime, you can never vote again, period, even when you're released from prison and reengage. Then there's another approach where you can vote even while you're in prison. And a number of countries and a few states do that. So there are various approaches. And then the other approach, which we had in Maryland, is once you serve your time and get out, you can vote. I think it's important that we allow individuals, after they've served their time, to reengage in the democratic process. And that means once they serve their time and get out, we should allow them without too many hurdles. And one of the problems is there are tremendous hurdles in states in terms of being able to exercise that voting right after you've served in prison. So we need to relax that rather than increase it.
Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 9 books, including The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. He is currently working with David Simon, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and James McBride on a project to bring his King trilogy to the screen in a 4-part HBO series. Michael Higginbotham is the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. His latest book is called Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Let's conclude our discussion about the Voting Rights Act by listening to part of what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had to say when he addressed the crowd in Montgomery, Alabama, at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March on March 25th, 1965. This was the march that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act 5 months later.
I know you're asking today, how long will it take? Somebody's asking, how long will prejudice blind the visions of men? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir,
however frustrating the hour, it will not be long, because truth crushed earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long? Yes,
because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long?
How
not long?
Long. How long?
Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes,
that scaffold sways the future.
Yes.
Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. addressing the crowd at the end of the march from Selma, Alabama, to the state capitol in Montgomery on March 25th, 1965. President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law 50 years ago. On 88.1, it's a special New Year's Day edition of Maryland Morning. Up next, we'll listen to several people who remember Coretta Scott King's visit to Baltimore in 1969. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Happy New Year. In the mid-1960s, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was drawing his movement's attention away from civil rights and towards economic justice. As African Americans were moving into cities, as jobs and factories were moving elsewhere, he considered the civil rights movement intertwined with the work of unions trying to raise wages and improve working conditions. Here's Dr. King in March of 1968.
For most of the poverty-stricken people in our country are working every day. They are making wages so inadequate that they cannot begin to function in the mainstream of the economic life of the nation. They are working, in many instances, full-time jobs for part-time income.
When he was assassinated a month later, Dr. King was in Memphis, Tennessee, organizing his Poor People's Campaign and preparing for a march with striking sanitation workers. Just days after his death, Coretta Scott King led a march in Memphis with those workers. And a year later, she came to Baltimore to speak to the Hospital and Nursing Home Employees Union, which was seeking the right to represent hospital workers. Mrs. King told the Baltimore Sun, quote, "I regard this election as tremendously important in the struggle to wipe out poverty wages and win a measure of self-respect and dignity for all Baltimore hospital workers." Producer Jonna McCone picks up the story.
Johns Hopkins Hospital in East Baltimore, even in the 1960s, was one of the best hospitals in the nation. And people organizing to improve the working conditions of African Americans in the city felt a place known for its innovative medical practices should also lead the way in fair wages. To understand the connection between the civil rights and workers' rights movements here in Baltimore, I spoke with longtime activist Bob Moore, who was awarded an Unsung Hero of the Civil Rights Movement Award by the City of Baltimore Community Relations Commission in 2000. I also sat down with two members of the 1199 Union, Annie Henry and Laura Pugh, who met Coretta Scott King in the late 60s. Bob Moore starts our story.
I'm Bob Moore, born in Baltimore over 70 years ago now. As a kid growing up in Baltimore, I was painfully aware of segregation and racism. When I was about 12, 13, I went with a white friend whose father owned a garage. We went to the white coffee pot. We both jumped on the counter. And then I was asked to get down. He thought it meant him too. But the waitress said, "No, hon, you can stay. He just can't not sit at the counter." Great French fries. But my mother later, when I was trying to clearly understand, chastised me for going into a place you weren't welcome in. I became, I guess, a full-time activist in the summer of 1964. It was a group of SDS, or Students for Democratic Society chapter at Hopkins and Goucher. We formed a thing called the Union for Jobs. Certainly, without jobs, freedom is kind of a hollow thing.
My name is Laura Pugh. I live in Northeast Baltimore. I worked at Hopkins, John Hopkins, for 40 years there. I am retired. 1199 involves in hospitals and nursing homes. They are throughout East Baltimore, West Baltimore, everywhere.
1199 had developed an ongoing relationship with Dr. King, and after his assassination, the relationship continued with SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Originally was Dr. King's, was the head of the organization. And after King's assassination, I guess the union proposed to continue Dr. King's work on what had become his anti-poverty initiatives. To serve that mission, the union agreed to help lead a campaign to organize hospital workers. When the union came to Baltimore, the Baltimore riots had sort of changed the atmosphere in the city in many ways.
My name is Annie M. Henry. I have been employed at Johns Hopkins for 45 years. The job that I do now, I've had it at least 43 years. I come from a union family. My father worked at Sparrows Point for years, and he was a union man. That was in 1969 when the union came. I'd been employed at Hopkins for 6 months. I started there in April the 24th. 1969, and by that December, when the union came, I was ready to go. because it was not a nice place to work. A lot of prejudices, a lot of hateful, mean things going on.
We only went in certain doors, and that was Rutland Avenue. We were not allowed to go in the front door, the back, all those doors. And that was housekeeping, nutrition, escort services, and engineering. And that meant that we couldn't go up on the first floor. They didn't want us up there. This is the way it was, and you didn't change it because of this is the way it was. We wore yellow and white uniforms and nurses' shoes. You had to be clean. Everything had to be clean on you in order to work at Hopkins.
A lot of the managers and supervisors, they were very disrespectful, and they assumed because you were doing a menial job that you were an ignorant person, and that's not the case. Once the union came, it was a raise. You could see a few pennies. It wasn't dollars. You could see a few pennies. It was better than what we were making at the time.
Coretta was co-chair of what was the 1199 National Organizing Committee.
We got to go see her on our lunch break, and you had to take your lunch break, and you had to be back on time. But she spoke about nonviolence. She spoke about standing up for our rights. She spoke about women stepping to the plate.
So people swarmed out the doors of Hopkins Hospital greeting her. Hospital management people stood on a second floor window peering down, but never thought sense enough to come out.
When Coretta Scott King came, it was a lot of excitement. She spoke about her husband, Dr. Martin Luther King, and she said that we was his favorite union, and, you know, this union held a special place in her heart. And she talked about how we, with the management, could try to make it a better working conditions. And at times when she could, and her bodyguards and whatnot allowed her, she would come through the audience and, you know, shake people's hands and ask questions and whatnot. When they took the union vote, I hollered, I screamed, I prayed, I did everything. I was so happy that the union was able to get in John Hopkins.
In 1970, I was 19 years old, and I made $2.10. An hour. I would bring home $52 a week. And I learned that through this union. You know, we have to be together. If we work hard, then we should be paid hard money. In 2014, they were able to raise their wages past poverty. Now, that's how long it took them, from 1970 to 2014.
Annie Henry still works at Hopkins Hospital. Laura Pugh retired in 2010. Bob Moore is working on a memoir about civil rights and his work as an organizer. Thanks to producer Jonna McCone for this story. Maryland Morning is produced by Rob Sivak, Jonna McCone, and Kathleen Cahill. Scott Seiss helps us out as well. My co-host Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Austin Coughlin at Clean Cuts wrote our theme music. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville provides coffee for our guests. You can check them out at zekescoffee.com. That's it for us today. We'll be back with you on Monday morning. I'm Tom Hall. Happy New Year.